think everyone was probably concerned that if, you know, if I speak out, maybe I won't get treatment, or if I speak out, maybe I might become a victim.
Absolutely. And that's constantly. When I was in France, for example, I, at the time, collapse of the Soviet Union, I didn't have any documents. So I needed to get my, permanent residence here. So, well, at least they gave me that. I mean, I had an expired Soviet passport. The Sudanese, refused to renew mine because of my journalism. I was stuck in Paris, and I remember it was like by the time I got this damp residency, I was so fed up, I was ready to leave.
Yeah.
But at that time it was 93, 94. They still had this regulation. If you are a foreign, but not all countries, I don't remember which ones, but if you're a foreign citizen but permanent resident, you were not allowed to leave France. You had to go to the central police, it's called la préfecture, and ask for permis de sortie. It's the permit to go out, so you need, and then to come back into the country. Okay, so it's like always packed with, you know, of course, non-French people. And I remember, the woman was just, I had to go for interviews, and the woman wouldn't give me, she just refused legitimate papers that they required. And she was like, I don't care for this, I don't care for that, da da da. Finally, she's like, you know, basically screw you, she screams, you don't need any permit, you know, to get out. Just like, fucking get out all, she screams at the whole.
Wow.
Okay? And, you know, around me are Africans, North Africans, South, you know, East, West, Central Africans, Eastern Europeans, you know, whoever. It's like, you know, the hall is packed. Everyone is waiting for that, you know, stupid permit. And you would think that they would get in solidarity and tell her, you know, come on, you know, stop this and do your job, and, you know, we wouldn't be here if your stupid laws not. Everyone jumped on me. They're like, oh, now you spoiled her mood, and she won't be nice to us.
Wow. Yeah, this is the mentality. Yeah, yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
And this is the mentality, and it's almost like I was surprised. I wasn't even upset with them, because in a way, you kind of, well, you know, in this domestication, you try so hard to please your master. Well, not even please your master, because there's a lot of hassle, a lot of pain involved with all of these regulations, with all of these ways of categorizing you as the othering schemas. You know, you understand that, okay, you know, they have a lot of to lose, you know, and everything depends on this one monster, you know, and her mood. And maybe she's not a monster in her real life, but in that relationship she is.
Yeah.
In that relationship she's a total totalitarian, a tyrant. And everybody kind of like just squeaks and, you know, and does what she wants, and they get upset with somebody who gets the tyrant upset. Whereas, you know, you should all get together and change this. Well, you know, finally I jumped over the counter and I scared her, and she thought I was going to kill her or something. She called security. I left the country. 2 years later I had to go there. I went to Japan, Sweden. After Sweden, I had to go and get something. You know, just to, I was applying for immigration to Canada. And I go back, and it did change. Well, the fact that I jumped over the counter and I grabbed her and I said, you're going to read these papers and going to give me what I need, and I'm going to get the fuck out of here and never come back. Okay, she didn't do it then, but it changed something, at least. They had, at that time, a black guy, sit and look and watch. They had another woman. So it wasn't just one tyrant, there were two. And the black guy was observing them. I asked him, like, so what's new? And he's like, oh, there was a crazy nut who jumped over the counter 2 years ago.
That's great. But that's what it takes. I mean, this is a great segue, because I think for us, you know, as people who might be living in this society who are oppressed, we, a lot of times we just sit back and take it, and we, you know, fight amongst ourselves, and we have this horizontal hostility all the time. And we're always afraid to like jump over the counter and demand like our rights and demand, you know, what we need. And I think the last time this really happened here in the United States was maybe during the 60s with, you know, Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and the Black Freedom movements that happened with the Black Panthers or whatever. People were in that mindset back then. But it seems that right now, you know, everyone is so worried about holding on to the little bit of resources that they have that they're afraid to even, you know, raise the voice at the master and say, excuse me, something's not right here. So when this Trayvon Martin incident happened, you know, a part of my mind was like, you know, why aren't people, you know, out rampaging in the streets or whatever? Then President Obama came on and said, oh, Trayvon Martin could have been my son. And I was like, oh God, I mean, this is like his job, you know, to like pacify the angry black people so that they don't get too upset. You know what I mean? And it's like the more time goes on, we're finding out more things about this George Zimmerman character. The fact that he's the son of a judge, a retired judge. We also found out that, there's a video of him coming into the police station. His nose isn't bloody. There's no grass stains on his back. So there's nothing that looks like he was in a struggle. He's just wearing a jacket and he has a bald head, and you can see the back of his head. There's no gash. There's no wound. He looks totally fine, totally calm and collected. And people keep asking themselves, why is this person still free? I mean, why is he not in jail right now? So listening to everything that you've been saying up till now, it becomes clear that this George Zimmerman person, you know, it doesn't matter what his race is. They're arguing about whether he's white or Latino or whatever. His status in society is such that he's more valued as a resource than Trayvon Martin as a young, you know, 17-year-old black man or black kid or whatever. So his death ultimately doesn't matter. I mean, what matters is this guy who is related to these centers of power through his father, the judge, through his, you can look at him and he kind of looks white. So he does have that sort of white privilege. And this is what I think a lot of people are missing. They're missing the institutional analysis of what's going on instead of just seeing it as just like, you know, the evil white people are trying to kill us or something like that. I'm sure you've been hearing about the Trayvon Martin thing. How would you apply your analysis to that situation?
Well, first of all, it's really difficult to talk, to analyze even these situations because, I mean, it's the, all of these cases and all the others of whom, you know, we even have the chance to talk. I mean, it's incredible. It's incredible that it goes on. It's incredible the pain, the meaninglessness of mm-hmm. these losses, just, you know, in terms of, obviously in terms of just life. But they have very specific, unfortunately, at the same time, they have very concrete, specific meaning in this civilization, in this civilized narrative. And, you're absolutely right. It doesn't matter at this point the details that they would paint Zimmerman as, you know, white or not white. He stands for a class. He protects a certain class and its privileges. This class, I mean, over and over, what terrifies, like what people find appalling is that it's a gated community, and how can, well, just because this is a black kid, this guy goes and kills him. The larger narrative frames it that the gated community itself exists because you're going to shot people and animals and, you know, other species out.
Right.
Right? So the whole premise of that, Zimmerman was protecting that gated community. The narrative structures it that it's the white privilege to have a gated community. It was like that during the invasion, with the slavery, so-called post-slavery. I mean, this is what hasn't changed. There is a group that's going to guard and gate their privileges, their basically loot, because the privileges have been stolen from all the other people. So in this respect, it makes sense that the police would not arrest, like, okay, a black kid. In this narrative, okay, this was a mistake. It so happens that the kid's father lived in this gated community, but they're not supposed to.
Right, yeah.
This is what the narrative tells us. They're not supposed to. And Zimmerman was protecting. Okay, he made a mistake. It's one cuckoo, but he was doing his job. Forgive the guy. Give him a break. Okay? Mm-hmm. Because ultimately the narrative itself, structures it that way, and anyone who goes into that contract, who goes into that gated community, signs this tacit agreement that someone else has to be shot and not allowed in. You're trespassing.
Right.
Okay? And that's the ultimate tragedy. It's tragic, the fact that obviously, you know, you look, of course, you know, you say, well, what should black people do? Like not try to, you know, to better their lives? This is, of course, I'm not saying that. It's horrible that, they still will not be accepted, no matter what. In this respect, Obama was right. You know, if he had a son, he's still wearing a hoodie, might be shot. This is as far as he can go to acknowledge the narrative. But then, at the same time, he plays the role, the symbolic role in that narrative. And, I see people are saying, don't politicize, this is, you know, you can't politicize this whole case of Trayvon Martin. And, the thing is, I agree and disagree with that statement. I agree with the fact that you should not take it as a symbol to represent all the other kids. Because every kid, every Anna Brown, every woman, every man, you know, everyone who perishes because she or he is not admitted to the hospital, she or he is so-called mistaken for a thug or a thief. I mean, the whole gated community means that those people are already thieves because they stole something from the resources they oppress, the resources they oust. But the narrative frames it in a different way. And so you cannot take every tragedy is the tragedy. This is the tragedy of Trayvon Martin and his family. And it cannot be taken to represent others. But at the same time, you cannot say, oh, it's not a political thing, because everything is this in this narrative is a political thing. It is a political thing. It is about how are we willing to not divide our, not to share our so-called resources and our privileges.
Exactly, yeah.
And so it should be talked about. Every case should be talked about. But not to forget that by also, I mean, it's totally insane, and it should not be relevant whether the kid was suspended in school or not.
Yeah, what was that about? Why are they trying to, you know, drag his name through the mud? I mean, what 17-year-old hasn't been in some sort of trouble in school? I mean, you
Exactly.
know, it's pretty sickening.
Tim Wise, in his talk on the pathology of white privilege, talks about actually the fact that, according to the statistics, people of color are stopped for drugs and searched 3.5 times as much as white people, but white people are more likely to have drugs on them and use them 4.7 times
Oh,
as
well, of
much.
course. I mean, I lived in Europe, so it's not exactly the same thing, but I'll tell you that a lot of people over there are doing massive amounts of drugs. And they're carrying drugs around all the time, ecstasy, cocaine, you know,
Yeah.
hashish, whatever. And it happens here too, but because if you have the this idea of whiteness as being pure and good and, you know, desirable, you're not going to naturally associate that with drug addiction or crime or whatever. And that's really the, not like drugs should be associated with crime, you know, in the first place, but it's really unfortunate that these perceptions can have such a damaging effect on people's lives, and that some people who are, you know, they're embedded in this system of privilege just refuse, they refuse to acknowledge it. And I'm glad you mentioned white privilege again, because I wanted to talk about something that doesn't really get talked about too much. And this is the utility of white privilege in our society, and the fact that many white people don't view themselves as resources, but they are, just like we all are to the, you know, to the dominant classes. How does white privilege actually facilitate white people as a resource? I mean, how does it, I mean, we know that it elevates them, it gives them certain benefits, but what is the ultimate goal of white privilege? I mean, why do they have it? What is it used for? And we see that some people are losing their privilege right now, and this is why we have the Occupy movement and things like that. But what role does white privilege really play in our society, and what is it really all about, in your opinion?
Well, there's a lot of interesting studies and essays and talks by different people of color and on white privilege. I mean, obviously, the whole construct of whiteness, I mean, is a North American construct. When Europeans started colonizing the world, it was more, they didn't look at themselves as white or as of particular color. I mean, they started off with Orientalism, with the concepts of okay, we the Europeans and the reason that dominates over the body and the savage impulses, and so you start depicting, okay, and the Africans were depicted kind of sometimes with tails, like so you degrade apes and animals. And Nikisha Alexis Baker in her talk like shows beautifully how it all escalates and how at first these philosophers of the Enlightenment had to construct the animal as someone who is not capable of reasoning, of sentience, of meaning, of suffering, of the ability to suffer, of empathy. And all of these characteristics, they indicate consciousness and awareness. And so the Europeans then flip it around. Instead of saying, okay, consciousness and awareness, with that comes intelligence and the ability to live well in this world, basically is bound to our ability to understand the world and how feels and when it gets ill and when it is well, and so you contribute to its wellness, to life. The philosophers of the Enlightenment flipped it around and started saying, well, with Descartes and all this, you know, the invention of human reason. And the human reason is separate from those animals, from those instincts. And that's the institutionalization of apathy and cruelty. Nikisha then says that actually consumption of meat starts getting on the rise with that construct of narrative and with industrialization, industrial farming, industrial everything, more people and more suffering, more enslavement of animals. And then you suddenly invent other human races as animalistic as those degraded beings that you have constructed. So then you get the Oriental, you know, who's kind of half-witted, you know, over-sensual, and, you know, and the African who's there to be used for labor and abused because they don't feel. They're like animals. Do anything you like and they won't feel. They're not sentient. And, in this respect then, I'm tired, started. In this respect, the construct of whiteness, started off, actually, it's an American invention. I'm not even sure I've been to Australia, but, I don't remember, I remember the racism there was very different from Canada and the United States. And obviously today, you know, the construct of whiteness is part of this whole colonization process. But I don't remember how it was. It feels very, very American. And in the States, of course, when you look at how you divide the classes and the privileges, because in Europe, they had slaves as well. You know, the Greeks had slaves, the way the English treated the Irish, I mean, if that's not feudalism, the French treated the French. So it was feudalism and slavery together with civilization marched hand in hand. And at a certain point, it became more convenient and more profitable to give these people, well, the people that you exploit of the same race, this illusion that they are agents of their lives. Okay, the non-humans, they're not agents of their lives, and so they are rightly oppressed and enslaved. So you kind of don't ask them. But these people, if you give them the illusion that they are the agents, they have the choice, and they decide. And especially with education, if you can have them believe that not only have they chosen it, but they love their profession.
Right.
They won't see their professionalization as ultimate invalidity. Like, you are an invalid, you cannot live independently and forge your community, a diverse community, because you are specialized in only one aspect that you render service, you know, in that sphere, and this is what procures you your ability to live, but not to live for yourself, to live for that specialization, for that specialty. And then you create this sort of, they call it, I guess, satisfaction. Happiness is too much. Although some people might tell you, well, I'm happy. I'm a doctor. I'm happy. But even then, you would feel in comparison to others that you are well off. And so you derive satisfaction from that privilege. And so privilege plays a role in disarming your discontent. So if you know that tomorrow you can be, you can turn into Anna Brown or Trayvon Martin or, you know, millions of others, you are going to feel good about yourself that you're a nurse and you're exploited, or even nurse's aide. I mean, that's like the most exploited profession, in my opinion. From the studies I've seen and from my own medical anthropological research. And so privilege works here because it divides well, that if you are satisfied, you are going to cling to that position and to that myth of satisfaction.
Right. So this is, I think, so far been a really, really, really amazing analysis. I mean, it's not anything that we're going to hear on CNN or, you know, MSNBC, because it makes people look at our society in a way where, we're all kind of caught up in the mechanisms of civilization. And I'm not going to say that we're all victims of it, but we're all kind of playing our own roles. And some of us are, a little bit better off than others. But I think that if we can all view ourselves as needing to free ourselves from this, it would maybe help us to, you know, foster this sense of empathy and foster these, whatever it's going to take for us to break out of this, this mess that we're in right now. I know that you didn't sleep that much last night, and we've been talking for over an hour, so I don't want to drag this on too long. I just want to ask you finally, what solutions do you see? I mean, how can we move forward from this? Because the way things are going right now, I'm not sure if we're going to be seeing race riots or anything like that, but the very kind of degradation of personal relationships, like I've been seeing myself like not wanting to go into all white spaces as much, because I feel so like more uncomfortable now because of what's going on with the national discourse around race. I feel so much more self-conscious about it than I usually do. And this is like, these questions and these problems, they filter down to like every layer of society, and they kind of like mess up everything. But how can we move forward from this? How can we, those of us who are being oppressed and those of us who are, you know, working with the oppressors, how can we kind of dismantle these systems? I mean, how can we move forward from all this craziness that we're living in?
Yes, I mean, I totally understand and feel what you're saying, because I'm in this space with you myself.
Yeah.
And even though I'm here in Canada, in Quebec, I'm telling you, it's the dynamics are a little bit different. So, you know, visually, you go into our space and it looks as if the relations are different. But they're not.
Right.
It's the same. It's the same structure. It's the same parasitic, basically, tumor. How do we all liberate ourselves and help liberate others? Well, it's for white people to come out and abandon their privilege, you know. Until that happens, and it will, unfortunately, I mean, there are conscientious people, they have been throughout history, people, I mean, again, you know, to cite Peter Kropotkin, I mean, he was a prince, he abandoned that title, he abandoned his privileges, spent most of his life, he visited almost every jail in Europe, as participant observer, well, incarcerated. because of his feeling of solidarity with the oppressed. So you give up that privilege. It was maybe perhaps easier because he was mostly in his white society and it was mostly class. And for us living in such a structured racial apartheid, it's very difficult for a white person to abandon their privileges, because regardless, society will confer on them those privileges and will conquer and will divide and conquer with that. I mean, it's very difficult, for us to go and make a revolution when we know that we will always pay more We have less and we pay more, always, historically. It's very difficult. But there are people out there. How do we convince everybody else that it's better? It's not better, it's necessary, it's vital for everybody to give up this system because it's not working. It's a tumor, it's a cancer that will engulf them as well. Everybody yeah. else, but themselves too. I see a lot of people in, you know, showing solidarity, so they wear the hoodie, the hijab. For me, that, okay, I share that solidarity. I, you know, my heart is all, you know, with the Martin family, with the Browns, and, you know, with both families actually are Browns, the, in North Carolina and Anna Brown. Yeah. And everybody else. With all the animals that are slaughtered in the slaughterhouses, with all the animals that are hunted down ruthlessly, poisoned by our civilization and fertilizers and pesticides and etc. ad infinitum. The hoodie and the hijab are part of, to me, they're part of that oppression. So, showing solidarity, demands more responsibility to deconstruct, no, not deconstruct, destruct
right.
these narratives. The clothes themselves are symbols. In a way, they're our shroud that buries us in this death, which is civilization. Maybe our solidarity should be that everybody abandons what they have, and they walk out naked. Naked
yeah.
in the world. Part of the world. No prejudices. No narratives that structure us as desirable, undesirable, you know, ugly, not ugly, shameful, not shameful. Naked as the world has made us, as we have come out of it. And that is both metaphorically and literally. Metaphorically in terms of shedding all the privileges, shedding all the capital, material and symbolic. And also literally. Find a way to grow back into the world. Otherwise it's death. The clothes that we wear is our shroud.
It's amazing. And this is a... definitely give me a lot to think about, and I hope for our listeners too. I just want to add to that that, you know, a part of this, like, just shedding of this privilege and shedding of all the things that are holding us back, like, we have to find a way to reconnect with nature somehow. I know it's hard, especially for me living in a city, and that's why I just want to plug this event that's happening in June. I don't know if you heard about this. It's called Wild Roots Feral Futures. And it happens in Colorado every year. And basically, it's going to be this year from June 16th until June 24th. And it's going to be in the southwestern part of Colorado. And let's see, it says here that Wild Roots Feral Futures is an eco-defense, direct action, and rewilding encampment that will take place in the forest of southwestern Colorado in June, blah, 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 blah. It's informal, completely free, non-commercial, loosely organized campout operating on a shoestring budget, and is formed entirely of it's formed entirely of donated, scavenged, and liberated supplies, and it's sustained through 100% volunteer effort. There's a Facebook page for this. It's called Wild Roots Feral Futures. And I really, you know, urge everyone who wants to just kind of get away from, you know, civilization in general for a while, at least for a week or so, to consider coming out to this. I'm definitely going to go. And Layla, I think, I don't know if you can come to this, but it's something to maybe think about. Cause it sounds like it might be just, even it's just a temporary escape for people to maybe come together and meet other like-minded people. And plan and talk and just be away from the lights of the city and all the pollution and everything. And that's kind of what we need to kind of just reconnect with each other as human beings without these labels and without all of the bullshit that we have to deal with on a day-to-day basis. So as usual, it's been a real pleasure, Layla, talking to you.
Oh, and I'll also mention something that's happening on April 4th, from 4th to 6th. I don't know if you've seen it on my Facebook, and I should actually on my website. I should add.
Oh yeah, what's your website?
Announcements. Layla.miltsov.org. So Layla dot Miltsov, Miltsov.org. So I'll add also links, important links. But it's a 3-day conference at Haskell Indian Nations University in Lawrence, Kansas.
Oh, cool. Okay. So I'm gonna post that on the page too.
Yeah, yeah. So it's called Rights of Mother Earth, Restoring Indigenous Life, Ways of Responsibility and Respect.
And that's April 4th to 6th.
4th to 6th, yes.
Okay, cool.
Okay, thank you. It's always great to talk to you, Ron.
Okay, thanks, Layla.
Yep, talk to you soon.
Them sad eyes. Don't be discouraged. Ooh, I realize it's hard to take courage in a world full of people. You can lose sight of it all in the darkness that's inside you. Makes you feel so small. But I see your true color shining through. I see your true colors. That's why I love you. So don't be afraid to let them show, yeah, your true colors. Your true colors are beautiful. Whoa, like a rainbow. Show me a smile, then don't be unhappy. Can't remember when I last saw you laughing. If this world makes you crazy and you've taken all you can bear, call me up, because you know I'll be there. And I see your true color shining through. I see your true colors. That's why I love you. So don't be afraid to let them show your true colors. Your true colors are beautiful. World makes you crazy. You've taken all you can bear. Call me up, because you know I'll be there. And I see your true color shining through. And I see your true colors. That's why I love you. So don't be afraid to let them show your true colors. And I see your true colors. That's why I love you. So don't be afraid to let them show your true colors are beautiful.